The court will first hear the case of Waylon Urey, who is the appellant, versus the State of South Dakota appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Ellery Gray, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, we have Ms. Ann Meyer, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. With that, Mr. Gray, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And thank you for your recognition. On behalf of Mr. Urey, I appear before you today to ask the court to consider reverse convictions that he had issued against him after a jury trial in Meade County, and that this matter be remanded back to the trial court for a new trial. The issues that we presented here today are, one, dealing with courtroom closure, and two, dealing with, I'll call it a Miranda, probably better described as an Edwards issue. Now, for perhaps the benefit of our students here today, I'll spend just a moment touching on the background that brings us to this case. I do understand that we have a very good summary that's been drafted for our students, so I won't dwell too long on it. But as that summary indicates, my client, Mr. Urey, was charged with probably what would be considered perhaps the most heinous crimes imaginable. He was charged with first-degree rape, more colloquially that would be child rape, where he was accused of completing a oral sex act with his 4-year-old adopted niece and then photographing that transaction. That was what trial essentially was about. Now today we bring forward, well, let me back up. As bad as those allegations may be, they still need to be tested for their truth, and they need to be tested in a certain way. We're all familiar with jury trials. We've seen lawyers act on TV. But beyond that, there also needs to be ordinarily a testing of those allegations in a public forum, in a public trial. That's a constitutional guarantee for the Sixth Amendment of the United States, and it is in place to make sure that the jury knows when they're seeing these types of allegations, that it's impressed upon them that they are doing this in a public forum, that they are keenly aware of their sense of civic obligation. It helps to know if witnesses can know something else and to come forward. And there's a number of reasons why that public trial is so vitally important. Now, even though that is a vital, important, or a fundamental right to have that public jury trial, the U.S. Court and this court has recognized that under certain circumstances, there can be limited exceptions where the courtroom can be properly closed to the public. And in certain instances, when we're dealing with a child victim in a rape case, that can be one of the circumstances where, if the careful balancing test is undergone, that can be one of the reasons why a courtroom would be closed. It is our position here today that the trial court did not properly weigh factors, that the trial court really did not have the evidence that it needed to make that decision, and that closure was therefore conducted improperly. That closure resulted in what is known as structural error, which means that the trial lost its fundamental fairness, and the only remedy that is available to us now is to redo the trial in a public setting. Now, I know that our students have probably read about the case, but when we're talking about courtroom closure, the U.S. Supreme Court has issued a test, or they've put forward what needs to be established for the courtroom closure to be proper. And I realize it might not be as exciting to run through elements as it might be to watch a closing argument on TV, but I think it is important to go through those elements.
So these are the questions.
Yes.
If I could interrupt you. So these are the elements that are set out by the Supreme Court in Arizona, in the Waller case versus Georgia, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So I understand your argument to find fault with the findings of the circuit court, but my question is, what is the nature of your criticism specifically? Is it that they're wrong? Is it that they're incomplete? Is it that they're based upon an insufficient factual record and therefore they're maybe wrong? What's the nature of your arguments in that regard? Because you know as well as I did that the analysis by the circuit court did reference the Waller factors, did make certain determinations concerning all four of those factors. And so it's not as if it was overlooked. What precisely is the error that you're identifying?
So the specific error would be that the court Yes, the court got the analysis wrong, but that's because the court didn't do the analysis, if that makes sense. So understanding the court's question, we've had cases before, State v. Rolfe, for example, where the court closed the courtroom but didn't go through any analysis at all. That's not this case. Here, the state in advance brought up the issue before trial and said, we'd like to have the courtroom closed. Here are the reasons why, albeit very, very short. And the trial court said, I agree with the state, we're going to close the courtroom. So to maybe address your question more specifically.
It wasn't exactly that way. I mean, that's a good summary, I suppose, but the court just didn't, in a perfunctory way, say, at least my reading of the order, didn't in this sort of pro forma way say, I agree. The court said, here are these factors, and I'm going to consider them. First, there is the victim's age, psychological maturity, and then made certain determinations in succession. So there was a little more to it than that. Wouldn't you agree?
I wouldn't, and here's why. Well, maybe this would be the best way to phrase it. The court gave a good reason to close the courtroom. The court said, look, this child could undergo severe psychological trauma if she had to testify before an audience. But the court didn't take any facts or give any analysis to support why that would be the conclusion. Why should we believe that this child, EB in this case, is going to undergo severe psychological trauma if she testifies before an audience?
So do you think that in that regard, then, the factual determination that was a predicate part of the court's decision to close the courtroom was clearly erroneous, factually?
It would be clearly erroneous, but that would be because there were no facts for the court to rely on to find that. And so maybe a way to answer the court's question is if we turn to State versus Slota, a case that this court issued several years ago finding an appropriate closure under very similar circumstances. In that case, the court looked at the trial court record and said, all right, the trial judge before, well, afterwards, but he came back and he found on the record, based on testimony that was presented to him, that the child in that case was developmentally delayed. She was in a special education program. She had hearing problems. She had previously suffered abuse. She'd been removed from her home. And importantly, her father had testified, I'm going to paraphrase, but essentially, judge, if my daughter is required to testify in open court in front of people, that will cause her psychological damage. So the court, in a sense, had a peg to hang its hat on and said, all right, I find that testimony to be credible, and that's my basis for why the courtroom closure is appropriate in that case. Here, we show up for a motions hearing. We're handling several other issues. The state says we want to have this courtroom closed. Hey, she's young. She's 4. And so they go through some of the actual predicate, but they don't explain, maybe for reference, the meat and potatoes. They don't give the evidence to support those conclusions.
So, Mr. Gray, is it your position that before the courtroom, either fully or completely or partially, can be closed, there's got to be testimony received from the court on that, or can the court rely on what's in the record?
I don't know that I've seen if a court has answered that specific question. What's the threshold? Does there need to be live testimony, or can the court essentially take judicial notice? So I don't have an answer from case law for the court on that. We can run through some of the cases, but I would have to expound on that something of an answer. Here, when the court makes that determination in this case, we don't have psychological records for the court to take judicial notice of. We don't have background information or even the parents coming forward to say, perhaps not under oath, what might happen.
Well, maybe, maybe it's not even just judicial notice and the rule of evidence strict sense, and it's maybe just information that appears to be not disputed. So, for instance, the age, no quarrel there, right? The age of this victim is what the court said it was.
She was 5 at the time of trial.
And we know that this young girl was interviewed by a forensic interviewer, and we know that, albeit in a different context, but still in front of this same circuit judge, the forensic interviewer told or testified about, you know, some reticence that the young child had guarding and some of these other types of issues. Also indicated, if I'm thinking about it correctly, that the child was young on the spectrum of child victims who could be expected to talk about something like this. I think 3 years or 36 months is the maturity level. So we know that on the spectrum, the trial court could know on the spectrum, this is a younger person on that spectrum. So those things aren't really controverted, are they?
They are not. Well, the age. Now, how psychologically mature is the child? That's something that the trial court would really need to make a determination on, maybe borrowing from some other doctrines. No witness is determined to be inherently reliable or unreliable. It's a case-by-case basis. So I think I'm answering the court's question, but if we start down the line of, okay, the judge can take notice that she's four, she's going to be young, we're going to close the courtroom, we run afoul of the U.S. Supreme Court's prohibition from Globe newspaper versus Superior Court of Norfolk County. In that case, basically, a trial court had a policy. If we have a very young victim in a child sex case, we're going to close the courtroom. The U.S. Supreme Court came back and said, you can't have a per se policy, and this recognized that also in State versus Sloat, and said, look, you might have young kids, but we still have to do a careful case-by-case analysis in each case, and as every court that's reviewed this issue has said, it's going to be very rare when we close the courtroom. So I guess my answer to your question, legally, no, we need something more than just the judge taking judicial notice of an age.
So, Mr. Gray, in this case, besides age, what else was in the record that supports the trial court's decision in your view?
We have, I will concede in this case, we have the nature of the allegations as well. So the court can take judicial notice. He knows that this is going to be a sex case. He knows that this is going to be a child pornography case. The judge also knows that the defendant in this matter is the adoptive uncle to the alleged victim. So he has those issues to which he can rely on. Whether it's judicial notice or evidence, those were issues that were not contested.
Go ahead and answer Justice Jensen's question. I'm sorry.
Certainly. And maybe this will get to where I think you might be going. In this particular case, though, we do have some evidence from a psychologist who came and testified at a hearing. Can the judge take judicial notice of those? Can he cross-apply from one issue and come over and say, well, I'm going to come back and use it for the hearsay issue? I'll take evidence from there, and I'm going to start applying it also to the courtroom closure issue. In this case, I would object to that being done for several reasons. First, as we're getting ready for the hearing, it's 3 days before our evidentiary hearing that the state files its written notice that it intends to seek courtroom closure. It's a very bare bones, but they did provide notice. We show up, the state's ready to do its hearsay argument. They want to argue some hearsay statements from the child should come in, and they bring a psychologist to testify about that. Importantly, the state limited that testimony at the time of that hearing to that issue. State never said, hey, judge, I want you to use this for purposes of the courtroom hearing. That's important because had I known that that was the type of evidence that was going to be used, had I been informed, I would have conducted my cross-examination of that witness very differently. As the court's aware, I also had a psychologist of my own assisting. Had I known that that was going to come up, I would have brought him to come in to help rebut or at least to assist me in clarifying those issues. Now, beyond that, when the state presented its brief, so the trial court's there at the trial hearing, or at the motions hearing, we kind of deal with that first issue, and the judge says, brief it for me, let's move on. Brief the courtroom closure. When the state briefed the courtroom closure issue, they never came back and said, hey, judge, we had our psychologist at that last hearing. You should rely on what she said for your courtroom closure analysis. Importantly, then, the next step is the trial judge never said he was relying on those statements from the psychologist. He didn't, in his findings, say, I find Dr. Holly Strand to be credible when she said X, Y, and Z. We don't know if the trial judge found that credible. And the next final issue is the psychologist never testified. She never presented evidence saying, hey, if this girl testifies before a large audience, it's going to psychologically damage her. So to come back on appeal and say we've got a record we can rely on really truncates and short circuits the adversarial process. So I would ask the court not to rely on those because no one up until this point has.
You don't think that that's a permissible inference is kind of your argument. that a trial court just can't say, well, because of the age, because some other circumstances aren't really controverted, and because of the nature of the allegations here and their serious subject matter, that I'm going to conclude that this could cause some psychological damage to the child. The court can't make that inference on its own, unassisted by expert testimony.
You wouldn't need, the court would not need expert testimony per se, but it needs something to hang its hat on. Whether that's testimony from a parent, whether that's some other evidence coming in, but if the trial court says, okay, I know she's four, and I know these are hideous accusations, and we run afoul of that per se rule, and I have a quotation from Davis versus Reynolds, if that helps. But I don't want to cut the court off if you've got a question.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you. And I understand that part of your argument. Your view is this can't become, is that the quote that talks about the ordinary hardships?
It's the ordinary hardships, and you cannot justify an automatic closure and a general exclusion of the public in every case involving a young victim in sordid and heinous details. And that's really what we have. We've got the heinous details. We've got a young victim, but we need something else. Otherwise, we'll end up just closing the courtroom every time that we have these types of issues come up.
Is this, again, in the constitutional analysis, that this was not a complete closure? And so we've recognized, as you know from our Slaughter decision, that a court closure that is a complete closure requires an overriding interest. However, substantial justification, which seems a more modest showing, is required where we have a partial closure. Would you agree that the substantial justification is the correct principle to apply here?
If you allow me to answer it in two ways. First, I'll say that no, that's not appropriate. The United States Supreme Court has never recognized limited closure. In this case, the only people allowed to remain in are essentially the alleged victim's supporters.
But has the Supreme Court foreclosed it? Because we've decided that.
That's
so we
correct.
Were, under principles of stare decisis, we would be obligated to follow our precedent unless we decided it was wrong, I suppose.
That's correct. And so under State versus Slode and State versus Rolfe, that is the law in our state. So here's my second answer. That really only applies to the first prong of Waller. Can the state establish a compelling interest or a significant one? I'm going to concede. Okay, if we go lower, significant, I'll concede that the higher level, if we've got a child who truly will be significantly traumatized by having to testify in front of an audience, that's a compelling interest, and numerous courts, including the Supreme Court, have recognized that. But that's only check one. We have to go through and we have to answer the question, okay, why should we believe that this child's going to suffer significant psychological damage if she testifies before a audience or before a crowded courtroom? So really, it doesn't matter because the state, you know, they've given lip service. They have properly identified a significant or overriding interest. The question is, can they prove now that it's going to be prejudiced without the courtroom closure?
Thank you.
And so what I think might be helpful is to compare this case to some of the other cases that have been decided and to perhaps get
back
to—
2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you. Well, perhaps I should do this. We also have the Edwards issue. And for the court's consideration, we have in this case a defendant concededly not in custody. And he's asked by law enforcement, would you be willing to give us a statement? And I'm paraphrasing, essentially says, I'd like to have my lawyer get in contact with you. And indeed, that happens. A lawyer calls law enforcement. Our position is that should be enough to protect that attorney-client relationship. Initially, the trial judge agreed with us, received no authority, and disagreed. It'll be for this court to determine when it looks at that mixed question of law and fact. Was there indeed an assertion of the attorney-client privilege? And is that such a nature that it should have been respected 7.5 months later when law enforcement reapproached the defendant and asked for that second interview?
Mr. Gray, I don't mean to overlook that part of your argument, because I understand it, but the bright line rule of Edwards versus Arizona, as you know, is an extension of Miranda versus Arizona. It depends upon custody and the custodial nature of the questioning. I read your brief. be consistent with what you just said here, which is an acknowledgement that your client was not in custody.
Correct.
The bright-line rule of Edwards versus Arizona, arguably, I think it appears clearly, doesn't apply.
And so,
how is it that you won this issue?
So what the court would need to do for me to win this issue is you would need to say, okay, under Edwards, he's not in custody. But this is different than Edwards because he has an actual attorney that shows up. Now, there's case law that says that law enforcement apparently can reapproach a defendant even if he has an attorney. This court will need to determine what are the appropriate bounds of that.
But you don't win under Edwards versus Arizona. You're
strictly, I'm sorry, yeah, strictly speaking, I'll need more than simply Edwards versus Arizona to win this issue.
And your time has expired. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
May I please the court, this idea of cross-referencing evidence, there is a precedent for that. If you look at the facts in Rolfe 2, both this court and the trial court talked about the 404B hearing, which is a prior acts hearing and took place before trial. That was an important part of the analysis that the trial court used to close the trial, because it showed the demeanor and also the background on the child. And that's what we're saying about the entire record in this case should count. And the trial court's the gatekeeper for this. He's the one who decides whether the trial has to be closed or not. We have a 5-year-old little girl, and she has to testify about abuse by a family member. That's the worst case scenario that we've seen before this court in the 5 or 4 preceding cases. The other children ranged from 8 to 13. It's obvious that this little girl is going to have a tough time getting up there and talking about what's going on. And the trial court certainly has the intelligence and the capability to decide whether the court has to close the trial. It's only a small amount of time. And I wanted to point out to the court that her testimony comprises 11 pages of a 575-page transcript. Her forensic views were played in open court. They're video and they're also audio. The trial court mentions this in the first page of his memorandum decision. He listened to Strand. The exhibits are listened to. He said, I'm going to listen to him at the pretrial hearing. He has all of this evidence before him. He's not just trying to cross-check evidence or hang his hat on something that doesn't exist.
But what about Mr. Gray's argument that is essentially positing that, hey, if I would have known that this is what was at stake and that the judge was going to make this kind of a determination, I would have been prepared for this with appropriate cross-examination and maybe my own expert. So this kind of comes up after the fact, and I didn't know that we were talking about this.
Works both ways. The defendant has the opportunity to ask for a continuance. He could have brought his witness on. It's called in South Dakota waiting in the weeds. And he has a chance after the trial court puts his memorandum decision out there and he objects to that, he can ask for a motion for reconsideration. We did it on the suppression. The defense has some obligation to go for it. If he thinks this record is inadequate, it's not just all on the state. The trial court said, I want you guys to brief it. And so it was briefed, and he had the briefs before him. And what did he look at? He did look at this child's age. It's not something to be minimized in this case. He looked at the fact that she has her psychological understanding. He looked at the fact that she has, it's quite low here, not because she's developmentally or physically disabled. It's because this child is in kindergarten. That is the stage of her life cycle where she is. It's obvious that she's going to have difficulties getting up there. She needs support. She has a victim assistance person sitting with her so she can get through this. And the court's taking that into consideration. He's also looking at the fact that we have over 30 serious felony crimes in this case. And he's looking at the fact that this is narrowly tailored as possible so that it's just her testimony. The rest of the trial is completely open. And there are no other reasonable alternatives. I know that the defense attorney has protested in his brief that that wasn't considered, but the state in its brief specifically mentions that there's an option where you could do a closed-circuit television, but it doesn't really work out in practicality, as this court knows, and has said before in the preceding cases, because it compromises the defendant's fair trial rights. You can't really look at the child eye to eye and talk to her.
So you have age, seriousness of charges, and family member perpetrator, those facts. Are those facts, in the state's estimation, sufficient?
And the fact that it's narrowly tailored and there are no other alternatives, we met the Waller test. The trial court met the Waller test. And you see, one of the cases that's very close to this case is the Bauer case. And I know you can't have dead witnesses, but there were no live witnesses at that in that particular case because the defense, not Mr. Gray at the time, did not object. And this court said there's a benefit to closing the trial. They found the trial court made oral findings, much like in this case, and this court upheld it. There's a benefit for both sides because if we have a search for truth when we have a trial, we have a young sexual abuse victim who has to testify in a lot of family controversy. Both sides want the truth. They want this child to feel comfortable. They want her to be able to tell her story so that the state can bring it out and so the defense can bring it out. And Bauer's very close to this case, and that was sufficient to close the trial in Bauer. And that's what we're saying in this case, very analogous. It's sufficient. It may not be the most elaborate because we don't have a child who's had a disruptive life, but it's certainly enough to get there. And if it isn't, excuse me, our alternative argument is that we've certainly used remand in the past in Rolfe 1 and 2, and that's always an option for this court. There's nothing in Weaver that says it's addressing remedies. Then this court said in Salata, well spoken, that the remedy has to fit the violation. What he's arguing is too extreme. All we would need is a remand in this case if there is a problem with the evidence, if the court decides that that's the case.
Well, it's structural error. I mean, you could say the remedy is too extreme, but I mean, we don't test for harmlessness in a claim like this, and that's what makes it structural, so.
But it's not structural error in a child sexual abuse case.
It's not structural error in what, I'm sorry?
It's not structural error here because we have a rare exception. It's a long-standing tradition that we have an exception when there is a child sexual abuse situation involved. It's not just closing courtroom because of overcrowding, which is what you see in Weaver and which is what you see in Presley. And if you read Weaver very carefully, it says there are a lot of exceptions. There's a lot of qualifying language. They say not in all cases, generally, not in every case. And it also seems to limit the decision in that case to those facts.
Well, I mean, I agree with the general presumption. I don't think that's very controverted here that this is not an absolute right. Our statute, our cases
right.
Acknowledge that.
I disagree with that. It's not an absolute right. It has
no,
to be.
No, I said I agree with you. It's not an absolute
all
right.
All right, I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Yeah.
Yeah,
thank you.
It's not an absolute right. And there are cases, and there's a Harvard Law Review that Weaver cites to, 125, and it says there are exceptions. You can have exceptions for sensitive information, for an undercover agent, and certainly for a young child testifying about abuse by a family member.
Well, is it really an exception, or is it just the product of analyzing the case under the Waller factors? I guess I'm troubled with this exception language. I don't know that it's an exception as much as it's maybe exceptional in the sense that the courtroom is closed or partially closed, and that's exceptional. But to me, the decision to close or partially close the courtroom has to be supported by the Waller analysis. And we can't, and maybe you're not suggesting this, but we can't just say, well, there's an exception for this kind of case. We've got to go through all this analysis. Do you agree with me?
Well, I'm not sure I do, because the cases that I looked at and the Weaver opinion said that there are instances when closure is certainly justified, and a partial closure, as you said before, is even more justified when it's a substantial reason. We don't need an overriding reason. When it's a partial closure, we need a substantial reason, but the court here did find that there was an overriding reason to close this trial to help
Your
this child.
Your time is rapidly sliding by. Is there other your time is rapidly sliding by. Are there other rebuttals that you have to the...
Thank you very much. There is a second issue here, and I wanted to get to that. We have the issue on suppression. The trial court decided that the defendant had not invoked his rights in the initial telephone conversation where a detective contacts him and wants to know if he can schedule an interview. And the defendant says, I've been talking to an attorney. I'll have them call you. You have to have three things there. You have to have a custodial situation. You have to have an interrogation. You have to have charges that have been filed before your constitutional rights attach. And the court said that the defendant had not clearly asked for an attorney. The next call that we have is a July 15 call. And in that call, the attorney says, I'm representing this person. You have to go through my office, but I'm invoking his rights for him. We have well-established law that an attorney can't act as an agent for the defendant in certain circumstances. When you are in custody, the defendant has to speak up for him or herself. You can't become the defendant and say, I'm waiving rights for that defendant. And that was, the attorney got off track. There's some kind of misunderstanding there. 2 days later, the most important call is this July 15 call. For this, at that point, the attorney doesn't remember the call, but the detective puts in his report and documents that he talked to the attorney. The attorney calls him back because he's left a message. It looks like there's going to be an indictment filed here. And the attorney calls back and he says, I'll help him turn him in, but I'm not going to be representing him in the criminal process. And we have a big delay here, which fits the Schatzer rule, because there is evidence that in this card with the pornography on it that isn't turned over. The family doesn't turn the card over to law enforcement for 4 months. It's been found, but in the door jamb in the defendant's bedroom by another person in the home, but it doesn't reach law enforcement for 4 months. And in that time frame, DCI has to do a forensic examination of that particular item to see what's on it, because there are other children involved. Then we jump, there's a big time gap, to July 22nd of 2016, and a DCI agent goes out and talks to the defendant at his, where he's staying in Box Elder, and tells the defendant, you don't have to talk to me, you can get up and leave. The defendant chooses to move to the DCI agent's vehicle. He makes admissions in the vehicle, but he never asks for an attorney. He's rewarned in the vehicle that you don't have to talk to me, and he never asks for an attorney. He knows the drill. He's not somebody off the street. He has been training to be, or taking classwork to take, to become a police officer at Western Votech, and he also recognizes some of the techniques that are being used. And he is, he knows this. He knows how to an attorney. He never asked for one. He never asked at one point for one. And in the final analysis, this attorney never represents the defendant at any point in the protection hearing or in the criminal proceeding. And it isn't a case where I'm sure the defense is going to bring this up, where there's some kind of abuse by law enforcement, and they're asking every 14 days for him to give them evidence. There's just one interview. It's non-custodial. Nobody has asked for it. It takes place 7.5 months later. Schatzer says, if we reapproach you after 14 days, then we can talk to you again, regardless of whether you have counsel. It's not contingent on whether someone has ask for counsel anymore. It's contingent on the time break. So if the court has any further questions.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Mr. Gray, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Thank you again.
Mr. Gray, can I ask you on issue two?
Please.
The non-Edwards situation. What's your most persuasive case or cases to support the theory that you're suggesting here?
The most persuasive case that I do have, frankly, is Edwards, because it talks about the importance of the attorney-client relationship, and it talks about law enforcement overbearing the free will of a defendant. And so this court will then need to decide, where do those parameters lie? Can any officer reapproach someone who has an attorney every 14 days? In the middle of trial, can law enforcement come to a defendant and say, hey, I know you're about to take the stand, would you be willing to talk with us for a second? Obviously, lawyers can't go and address other parties that are represented. And I realize there's a predicate factual position. Court will have to review Judge Day's findings. Was Mr. Roll acting as Mr. Urey's attorney? Would law enforcement have reasonably relied on that? Initially, Judge Day said yes. He then changed his factual findings to a no.
But Mr. Gray, that predicate factual finding seems pretty important.
It's vital.
So, I mean, you'd agree you can't just take the parts of Edwards or any case that you like and say, you know, that's what we're going to go with. That's the rule. You need to view it for its entirety and the entirety of its analysis. And the cases are, well, if not legion, there's a lot of them.
That's correct.
That say Edwards versus Arizona, Miranda, the progenitor, doesn't apply unless there's custody. So that seems like a big problem for your argument.
Here's the best answer I have for you. At some point, Miranda itself was new law. At some point, Schatzer was new law. The court had to sit down and say, this is the new rule that needs to apply in that situation. And I grant, to a very large extent, that's what I'm asking this court to do. And I don't have a treatise out there to give to you to say this is why this is good policy. But we had initially the trial court finding that that should be the law, and then he did change his mind, and that's why I bring that issue forward for this court, because
I appreciate
the trial court
your candor.
Found that.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do then is address, maybe to the closure issue, the question that the court had. What does a trial court need to do to properly close the courtroom? What can they take judicial notice of? As a humble practitioner, as you're writing the opinion and giving direction, I think it would make sense to inform trial courts that if you're, as the guardian of the public's right to a trial, if you're going to close that courtroom, you should take some form of evidence, just like you would do before allowing a minor or a young child to testify at a competency type of a situation. There should be some record that's made so this court can then review that carefully so we know what's being done when the appellate court reviews that.
So, counsel, did you make a proffer of evidence? Did you ask to call a psychologist or make a proffer of any form of evidence to support your contrary position on closure before the trial court?
I did not. And if I may, the reason was because at that time when the trial court issued its finding, I didn't realize that on appeal the state would then go back and rely on expert testimony. The trial court never said, I'm finding credible certain testimony or I'm going to rely on that. So it was, I didn't know that I was supposed to file that motion for reconsideration because I didn't hear about it until on an appeal. And importantly, the burden on courtroom closure does not shift to the defense. Under Presley versus Jordan, that duty lies on the trial court to properly do that. Remember in Presley versus Georgia, the defendant objects. He doesn't give those alternatives to the courtroom closure. On appeal, that was what the government argued. Hey, the defense didn't put anything forward, and the Supreme Court came back and said, no, doesn't matter that the defense didn't do that. That is on the judge as the guardian of that courtroom to issue those findings. Those findings that I retain are inadequate here.
We would revise or at least extend and change, however you want to use the whatever verb is best, but we would certainly have to revisit or reconcile what the remedy was in SLATA with any rule that required a trial court to conduct a pre-closure hearing, because we didn't, you know, our relief in SLATA was to remand for those findings, and so that seemingly would at least implicitly, you know, endorse the idea that you don't have to have that pre-closure hearing.
I think we're okay on SLOTA because there we did a pro hoc or an ad hoc. We went back afterward. The judge had heard the trial. The issue we come to with SLOTA is the remedy issue. So in State versus SLOTA, I argued very vigorously that the remedy that's prescribed is a new trial and cited Presley. This court reviewed Presley, very quickly addressed that and said, no, I was misreading Presley. That's not the required remedy. My argument to the court is under Weaver, the U.S. Supreme Court now has very clearly said that's really a matter of right. If there's structural error in a courtroom closure situation, as a matter of right, the defendant is entitled to a new trial. Conceitedly, that's dicta because that's not what happened in Weaver. That was an ineffective assistance of counsel. But the court did give us the direction how to interpret Waller and how to interpret Presley. And so if this court does find that the trial court did not adequately put enough facts in the record, as happened in Davis v. Reynolds, or as it happened in U.S. versus McIntosh, okay, then what should the remedy be? Should we remand and give Judge Day another chance to go through and decide if it was indeed an appropriate closure? I respectfully submit the U.S. Supreme Court's made that very clear since the time of Slodin Weaver.
So I'm right in thinking we would have to reverse our holding.
Yeah, you'll have to reverse your holding and Slodin and say that the remedy mandated by the Supreme Court is, in Weaver, a new trial.
Right.
If there are no other questions, for the benefit of the students, this has been a process that's gone over years, and we've come forward and we've dealt with these difficult issues through reason and through common sense. This is a system that I think, speaking for us all,